umpire. The newborn in the hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a triad, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Kim Barker, who was for almost 5 years the South Asia Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune, directing coverage of Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan, where she covered the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan and corruption in Afghanistan. She is now the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a General Assignment Reporter at ProPublica, working on enterprise and investigative stories. Her new book out this month is The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kim Barker.
Thanks for having me.
And your book is often wry and funny, and there's not a lot of humor to be gained from the moment. It does seem that the U.S. and Afghanistan have had such a star-crossed relationship, given that when the U.S. went in there after 9/11 and quickly eliminated the very few Americans involved, as a matter of fact, quickly eliminated the Taliban. I believe there was an expectation on the part of most Afghans that, oh, these are the people who put the man on the moon. They're going to fix our broken country. And nothing happened. And now things have just gotten worse and worse. And $1 trillion later, there's not much to show for it but mutual animosity.
Yeah, I know. It's actually, as somebody who's watched it for so long, it's very disheartening and sad to see what's happening there. And I did try to tell in my book, it's not like laugh out loud, funny, ha-ha. It's more dark humor and absurdist than anything else, because I had just started seeing these things happen and the same mistakes being repeated by the West there and the same mistakes being repeated by the Afghan and Pakistani leadership. The latest news is just, it's heartbreaking. I mean, I just know exactly what's going to happen and the fallout of what this is going to be.
Well, just walk us through that then, if you will.
Not going to be anything like the Quran burnings. The fallout from the Quran burnings is always going to be worse. Any time that you insult Islam or the Prophet, you're going to have more of a reaction in Afghanistan and Pakistan than you do with incidents like this. That doesn't mean that there's not going to be fallout from this, but I don't think you're going to see the same level of riots. I think you're going to more see perhaps targeted killings, looking at some sort of revenge against American troops. But I don't think you're going to see the same level of rallies. It doesn't really matter. It just, to me, just is another indication of where the relationship is at this point and how difficult it's going to be to achieve what the U.S. says its goals are before 2014.
Well, you have a chapter in your new book, Kim Barker, The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Chapter 3, American Idiot. And it does seem that it's pretty hard to comprehend how, after what had happened with earlier incidents involving the Quran burning, particularly that pastor down in Florida, that U.S. troops could be that unconscious to go ahead and do this and not recognize the dire consequences.
The ramifications. I think it has to do with a general, still to this day, more than 10 years on, lack of understanding about the culture and how religion and how Islam plays into the culture in Afghanistan and Pakistan and also throughout the Islamic world. I mean, it is just a book you cannot burn. There's very strict ways you've got to deal with old Qurans. When you read through the explanation of what happened, particularly the explanations in the New York Times, it does seem like this was just a mistake. It was just a bad mistake. But the fact that there was nobody that caught it before it happened, given how many times this seems to have happened in the past, is just, it's incredibly unfortunate.
Well, I'm just reminded of the fact that in tomorrow's election in Mississippi and Alabama, apparently a recent poll, we're going to be speaking with the pollster in a minute, indicates that over 40% of the electorate down there believe that Obama's a Muslim. So we have a kind of, I think as a culture, we have a kind of ignorance problem, don't we?
I can't really say whether as a culture we have an ignorance problem, and it's very difficult for me to speak to polls I haven't seen. I mean, I can talk about polls that I've seen in the past talking about, how folks did think that Saddam Hussein in Iraq was somehow involved with the 9/11 attacks. and that that was the reason that the U.S. had gone in there. And that is a problem. And it's always a problem when folks aren't actually paying attention to the news, but are instead just paying attention to what people regurgitate is the news. In other words, just sort of following the folks that, parroting the folks that say what they already believe. And that, as much as anything, is an indictment of what's happened to the news industry in America, and the fact that there is this fragmentation, and in terms of covering foreign news and covering these stories, you just don't have nearly as many people doing it as you did in the past.
So it's both a consequence of the news bureaus being cut and general society.
People just not paying, there's also, I think, a tendency to believe these conspiracies. It's interesting you bring up the Obama situation. As part of my reporting for the Chicago Tribune, I actually did go to Indonesia and take a look at his time there, and pulled his original school records, including the form that did initially list him as being enrolled in a Catholic school as a Muslim. But and that is used a lot of times as this is somehow proof that he was a Muslim growing up. But it doesn't get to the fact that in Indonesia at that particular time, most any kid would be listed as a Muslim despite his actual religion, just because that is the majority religion there. And the fact that the family that that Obama was living with at the time, his stepfather Lolo Satoru and his mother, did not identify themselves as Muslims.
And he did go to a Catholic school, which is not exactly common.
Catholic schools, as in large many parts of the world, are considered to be where you can get a good education. He went to a Catholic school for, I believe it was 3 years, and a public school for a little bit more than a year in Indonesia.
And most of the experts that I talked to, who some of whom speak the actual languages and spend time there, not too many have those qualifications, frankly. They're pretty much predicting a kind of a civil war when the U.S. pulls out. And if anything, this incident that just took place might well accelerate that. What do you think is the understanding in Pakistan, where anti-Americanism is pretty virulent and the cricket player is running on an anti-American ticket, and he's pretty much backed by the military there, and I don't know that we're even speaking with their military, and they're still closed off the supply routes following the killing of the Pakistani soldiers on the border.
There's a new leader of the ISI,
right, yes. Yeah.
Pakistan's main intelligence service. And he seems, at least from what I've read, to have more friendly relations with the U.S., and I know that the U.S. and the ISI are trying to work things out. But you're right. I mean, relations between Pakistan and America really, you can find incidents probably in the past that they were this bad, but I'm hard-pressed to think of any at this particular moment. What's going to happen in Afghanistan and Pakistan? As long as the West is talking about pulling out in 2014, the major fear over there, especially for Afghans, is that there is going to be civil war. It's not going to be the Taliban marching back in. It's not going to be some sort of coalition government that's going to be able to successfully pull off a transition, that the different groups and the different warlords are going to factionalize yet again and start fighting for who will control it. And that some group will eventually have to broker the peace, such as what happened in the 90s, and that group, of course, was the Taliban. I think Pakistan's interest in this is to try to come up with a government and support a government in Afghanistan that is seen as pro-Pakistan and not as pro-India, and they will do what it takes to get that particular government in place. And as far as Imran Khan, the cricket player you mentioned, being, a functionary of the military, maybe, but there are plenty of other functionaries of the military there. It's difficult to say that he is, particularly their guy.
Well,
I've heard other people say that.
That's true. I mean, I suppose the one thing you can say about the Pakistan military is that it's not so much a country with an army, but an army with a country.
Well, and that's exactly it. Whoever's going to run things and whoever's going to win the election, civilian-wise, it's pretty much the army and the ISI that are going to be pulling strings behind the scenes. I mean, you're seeing that right now. you know, the good things about this particular civilian government, it's certainly been able to hold on much longer than anybody had initially predicted. But it's the same sort of problems with it being a weak government, with it having, you know, no sense of institution, and its main goal seems to be to hold on to power rather than to you know, make any actual changes in the country.
But when you say, Kimbaka, that Pakistan would like a compliant government there, the one that
they would like a pro-Pakistan. Right.
Well, wouldn't that be a Taliban government?
Well, sure. I mean, that it's been that in the past. And that is something that people, you know, an expert suggests, is that they would want to have something like the Taliban again. And I guess it's really a question if the Taliban, if it were to come back, could ever be like it was in the past, if it could successfully close off a country that's been opened up to the world. I mean, can you really kick the internet out of Afghanistan altogether? Can you really kick TV at this point out of Afghanistan altogether? In a country, you know, where you've got, you know, something like 70% of folks there under age 30, and where you've got a lot of young folks in the city who have really sort of embraced the whole idea of moving forward and moving past war, are they going to accept going backwards into something like the Taliban regime of the 90s? It's better to ask Afghans that than to ask me, but the folks I know would say that would be very difficult to go back.
Well, but the question arises, surely, Kimbaka, about how that would then impact Pakistan if they have a compliant government there, but that is more radical than their own, and they already have a problem with the so-called Pakistan Taliban. Isn't that a possible scenario, like having a guard dog that takes over the whole house?
It's one possible scenario. I don't think it's the most likely scenario. You know, as you've mentioned, there is the Pakistan Taliban that has been a problem for the military, and certainly attacked the military. Kind of an example that you could say of like creating a Frankenstein-like creature that turns back on you. But I can't see an Afghan government that was run by that version of the Taliban coming back on Pakistan, because if the scenario you're playing out were to happen, it would involve Pakistan being somehow involved in helping them stabilize the country.
Well,
you
the last
can't say for sure that that's no. what's going to happen.
So, well, the last time the only support that the Afghan Taliban had was from Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, assuming that they would be a pariah state as they were before. It's difficult to see them being that strong, but I just wondered how resilient the state apparatus is in Pakistan, given the weakness of the government and the virulence of the anti-Americanism. Or do you think that once the American footprint goes away, the anti-Americanism will die down?
Well, yeah, I think it'll certainly diminish and it'll go down a bit. There's been a history of, you know, sort of upswings and downswings in how Pakistan and Pakistanis feel about Americans and the American government. But as far as the state being weak, it depends on how you define the state. If you define it as a civilian government, you know, yes, you can definitely say that. But if you define it as, you know, the entity that is running the country, which is essentially the military and its associated ISI groups, that's very strong. It's a very strong institution to the detriment of civil society and you know, other institutions that haven't really had a chance to develop yet.
So you don't share that pervasive idea that Pakistan could dissolve or at least its nuclear arsenal could...
I don't think that's a very pervasive idea. I think that, I mean, at least from talking to folks, that's a fear.
Right. Pervasive fear, then, yeah.
Yeah, most folks, most experts I know tend to feel like it's probably like Pakistan will simply muddle along, as it's always muddled along, you know, in this sort of gray area between state and failed state,
right,
where the military is pulling the strings.
Right, between a military government and a civilian kleptocracy.
Yeah. And, you know, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate for the people there. Well, I do think a large majority of them don't like the direction, the sort of like the military coming in and the back and forth between a military government and some sort of civilian facsimile.
Well, but there are some sobering facts here that Pakistan is, I believe, the world's fastest growing nuclear arsenal. They've surpassed numerically the French. They're probably equal to the British now. One does wonder why they need such a growing nuclear arsenal.
Well, I think if you were to ask Pakistanis, it's all about India, and it goes to the whole, you know, the whole what's happening in Afghanistan right now, which has a lot more to do with Pakistan's relationship with India than it necessarily does with 9/11 or anything that we think it has to do with.
Well, just in closing, Kimbaka, given the kind of poisonous nature of the current situation with this massacre of 16 civilians, 9 children asleep in their beds, on top of an already strained relationship where the average Afghan may have seen Americans as liberators in the first place, but now apparently see them as occupiers, and probably the average American soldier sees them as ungrateful people that we're making sacrifices for, and more often than not, NATO military trainers are being shot in the back by the people that they train. So there's an awful lot to suggest, you know, a star-crossed relationship, shall we say. But what is it about, and it's certainly reflected in your book, The Taliban Shuffle, what is it about the Afghans that you find appealing, given the negativity of the moment?
Geez, you know, it was one of those countries, and I think a lot of journalists will say this, where you go there and it just really gets under your skin, the people get under your skin, and I mean in a good way, not a bad way. Just the whole idea that, I don't know if I've ever been to a country that feels as foreign and as different in some ways, and then reminded me in other ways of where I grew up, Montana, you know, a place with guys with beards and guns and pickup trucks who don't like the government, plus the mountains, which is, of course, very similar to Afghanistan. But folks I met there, I mean, immediately you're meeting people and they're telling you their biggest secrets and their hopes and their dreams, and they had so many hopes and dreams in the beginning, and would invite you into their homes. Just this real naked optimism and this real just sort of outreach of friendship. And I've never had hospitality like that. I think but the place is beautiful. Many of the people were just so welcoming. And it's just incredibly sad to me and difficult to see how things are going. And in some ways I wrote the book, although it is darkly comic, as some sort of way to try to get people to pay attention to everything that had happened in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to try to see, you know, folks there as humans first, more than just sort of like this whole idea of the other.
Well, also there's this belief, you know, and an expectation that women are going to suffer if the Taliban take over. It doesn't sound, it sounds like the Pashtunwali hospitality was extended to you. It doesn't sound in any ways that, well, maybe in some ways, as a woman there, you didn't have such a bad time.
Well, yeah, and that's in large part because I was a foreign woman and I was a guest in the country, you know, so I didn't get treated like I was a local woman. I didn't get treated like I was a foreign man. It was almost as if I was some sort of like a third sex, you know, like that had equal access to both the women and the men.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. So do you think then, just in closing, that if the inevitable pullout is accelerated one way or the other, we're getting out, what's your final thoughts on that matter? I know we've talked about how the conventional wisdom is that there'll be a civil war. Is there any more optimistic possibility?
No. I mean, I really wish there was something I felt optimistic about. But, I mean, my feeling is if we're going to stay on this current path that we're on, and I see no indication that we're not going to stay on that path, that you've essentially told that entire region this is the end date. And it's very difficult to tell a nation of fence-sitters when you're talking about leaving at that particular time to then back you until then. I think it's more likely, just looking at human nature and looking at folks who have been at war, you know, for so long, that they're going to pick and they're going to side with not necessarily who they want to lead the country, but who they think will end up leading the country, which is a very different thing.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Kimbaka.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Kim Barker, who was for almost 5 years the South Asia Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune, directing coverage of Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan, where she covered the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan and corruption in Afghanistan. She is now the Edwin R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a General Assignment Reporter at ProPublica, working on enterprise and investigative stories. Her new book, just out, is The Taliban Shuffle, Strange Days in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the pollster who did the latest polls in Mississippi and Alabama.